Well, welcome everybody. My name is David Leese, and I'm your proud host of Leaders on the Frontier. And today we're live on both X and also YouTube. So a warm welcome to you on March the 14th, 2024, the year of our Lord. We're grateful to be able to have this session today with you. And we welcome your questions because we're going to be talking about transit of all things. Does transit actually serve you? Because this week, a landmark report, a study was released by the Frontier Center for Public Policy. And this report was done by its author, Randall O'Toole, who is a great colleague at Frontier, and he's the president of the Thoreau Institute. And so I want to welcome Randall O'Toole with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Randall, I very much appreciated reading the report, and I encourage people to look on the Frontier website. You can see the references to that transit report because it's a landmark report. I think it should be really quite a wake-up call to decision makers, the public right across the country. Of course, we're concerned about being able to get back and forth between not only work, but it's part of life to be able to have efficient transportation. And so it goes without saying, it's hard to believe that anyone would be against transit, but this report is pretty critical. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, Randall, but you're an economist, an analyst, but this report really begs the question. It doesn't sound like all the billions that we're spending in Canada is really serving our country. Am I misreading the top headline on this report, Randall? How would you, what's the punchline here?
Well, the transit systems that Canadian cities are building today are really perfect for those cities of 120 years ago. At that time, most jobs were in downtown areas. Most people didn't have cars. Roads were not great. And so you build rail transit lines to connect dense residential neighborhoods with downtowns where the jobs were. And people could take transit to work. They could take transit to shopping. There were often transit lines out to amusement parks and things like that. But most of the transit was oriented around the downtowns. Today, cities aren't like that anymore. Downtowns are no longer the location of most jobs. Just as an example, less than 10% of all jobs in the Calgary urban area are in downtown Calgary. And transit is still oriented towards those downtowns. So if you work in downtown Calgary, you're almost 50% likely to take transit to work. Almost half the people who work in downtown Calgary take transit to work. But people in the rest of the Calgary urban area, transit doesn't work for them. You're more than 90% likely to drive or use some other mode of transportation than you are to take transit to work in the rest of Calgary. So the transit agencies and cities have designed transit systems that serve 19th century cities, not 21st century cities. And they frantically are now spending billions of dollars on more rail transit that no longer makes sense. We've
Wow. So
invented a
this is
replacement technology, so it doesn't make sense anymore.
okay. So this is, I think a lot of Canadians would be really surprised to hear this, but it's like we're building these massive systems. We're spending billions, and we'll get to that in a moment. But you have eight cities or urban areas in particular across Canada, they're investing serious dollars, and they're getting their provincial, federal counterparts to throw in just tons of money into kind of like a model that's a kind of a dinosaur. You're saying it's really designed for cities the way they function like 100 years ago. They're not really, so what should we be doing here? Is that your point then, Randall?
Yes, even 100 years ago, cities were already transitioning. Henry Ford started using a moving assembly line to build Model T Fords in 1913. And he made the price of his cars so low that within just a few years, half of all American, and a few years later, half of all Canadian families owned their own automobiles. And as a result, not only did more people have cars, but the factories that made those cars couldn't fit in downtowns any longer. Mm-hmm. In 1910, most factories were in downtowns, but the factories needed to use moving assembly lines were a lot larger. For example, Henry Ford had a factory that was bigger than any downtown in Canada is today. It was just massive. Wow. And so the jobs moved out to the suburbs. The people who bought cars moved out to the suburbs and bought houses in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. Stores moved out to the suburbs to be near the people. And so downtowns were a lot less important than they are today, than they were then. They're a lot less important today than they were in 1910. So that transition was happening 100 years ago in the 1920s. It was slowed by the Depression, slowed by the war, but then really got moving after the war was over. And so any city that was built after the war basically is an automobile city, and transit just doesn't work in that kind of a city hardly at all, especially rail transit.
Okay. So from a kind of a common sense point of view, you're saying that the majority of business is not downtown. It's a fraction of what was decades ago. So why would you build all these kind of permanent or semi-permanent at best light railway lines to a downtown where it doesn't necessitate it? So does that, I mean, in the report, you state time and time again that in every one of these cities, the majority of the employment is not downtown. Is that how, that's the key difference that cities have changed? Is that it?
Not just the majority, but the vast majority, you know, 80 to 90% of jobs are not downtown in any urban area in Canada. Only one urban area in the United States has more than 20% of jobs downtown, and that's New York. And every other urban area in the United States is more like 10% or less. The average is outside of New York is only 6%. Canada is a little higher than the US, but not a lot. And nothing like New York is in, even Toronto isn't close to New York in the percentage of downtown jobs. So rail transit is doubly archaic. It's based on an archaic view of what the city is like. And it's an archaic technology.
Wow. Okay. So I'm talking with Randall O'Toole. He's an associate with the Frontier Center for Public Policy and just released a major report regarding transit systems for Canadian cities. So Randall, if we're thinking about building for the 21st century transit systems that work, is there a simple answer to that?
Yes. In 1927, the most modern transit technology of today was developed. That's not quite 100 years ago. It was called the bus. It was originally called an omnibus, and they shortened it to bus. And the buses of 1927 were the first buses made that were cheaper to buy and cheaper to operate. Buses were already cheaper to buy than streetcars or rail transit, but they weren't cheaper to operate until 1927. Well, after that, no new streetcar lines really were built anywhere. Instead, cities began tearing out their streetcar lines as they wore out and replacing them with buses. And buses have this tremendous advantage over streetcars in that, you know, our cities are dynamic. You know, we have different economic centers opening all the time. Other economic centers go into decline, and it's really, really easy to change bus routes in response to those changes in the economy. The pandemic hits, and a lot of people are working at home. You know, other things like this happen, and it's really easy to change buses to accommodate that. It's really, really hard to change rail lines. It costs a lot of money, and it takes a lot of time. Oftentimes you say, oh, there's a new economic center over here. Let's build a rail line to it. And by the time you get the rail line built to it, the center has disappeared. It's no longer an important economic center. It's because it takes so long to build rail lines today.
But wait a second, Randall.
Rails are archaic. buses are the modern technology.
But if they're so archaic, what the heck is going on here? Why is it cool for politician after politician to be cutting these ribbons of these multi-billion dollar facilities, and they're putting in effect, kind of dinosaurs, even though they're new? Why? What's driving this? Why is this happening, Randall?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is that you're more likely to get your picture in the paper cutting the ribbon for a billion-dollar rail line than you are introducing a half a million-dollar bus. Buses just aren't glamorous and exciting as big construction projects. But the more important is that the big advantage rails have over buses is that they cost a lot more. And when you're spending a lot more tax dollars, you're generating a lot of political favors for people. The contractors who build them, the engineering firms who design them, the rail car manufacturers who make the vehicles. And all of those groups then make campaign contributions and spend lobbying dollars. Millions of dollars a year are spent by companies like Siemens, which makes light rail cars, Alstom, which makes other train cars, and construction companies and engineering and design firms. They spend millions on lobbying and they spend millions on campaign contributions.
Wow.
So if you're a politician and you want to have a fat campaign war chest, then it makes more sense to spend billions of dollars of taxpayer money on a rail transit line that hardly anybody's going to ride than it does to improve the bus service.
Well, that's fascinating. So part of this is, yeah, I mean, you've analyzed literally hundreds of systems in North America. That's a kind of a common pattern, is you kind of have this coalition of industry interests who are very good at lobbying for big projects. And it isn't just the upfront capital costs that you have to, you know, spend to purchase these systems. You said it's the ongoing operating costs. What do you mean by that?
Well, when you have a bus line, the buses are using the same roads as cars and trucks and bicycles and pedestrians, and they're sharing the cost of that road. And so the cost to the bus agencies is very low of maintaining the road. If you've got a rail line, you have to maintain those rails to fairly precise standards, because if you lose those standards, if they get out of whack, then you start getting derailments, you start getting fires when the electrical systems aren't working well. All kinds of problems happen if you don't spend a lot of money on maintenance for a rail line that serves relatively few people, carries no freight, you can't bicycle on it, you can't even walk on it really. And so it's very narrow number of people are having to pay a huge amount of money to maintain these lines, and everything wears out. The tracks wear out, the signals wear out, the electrical systems wear out about every 30 years. And so every 30 years, you have to go back and spend almost as much as you spent building it in the first place, rebuilding everything, replacing the ties, replacing the rails. And that's extremely costly. And they never mention that when they say, oh, we'll build it, and then we'll have it for 100 years. 100 years if you build it and then rebuild it in 30 years and then rebuild it in 60 years and then rebuild it in 90 years. That's extremely costly. None of that happens with buses.
Okay, because Randall, in the public sphere within Canada, we just hear wonderful things about these light rail systems. A lot of cities are talking about them. They're even talking now about a big system between, say, Calgary and Edmonton. You've got, we've heard about challenges in different systems like cost overruns. Is that pretty common issue as well? Why do we get so many cost overruns on these systems?
Well, cost overruns happen for one of two reasons. Either the people who planned it were optimistic in their estimates, accidentally optimistic. It's really easy to think, well, let's see, the last one cost this much, so we can expect the next one will cost this much. And not take into account inflation and things like that. Mm-hmm. More likely, they're being deliberately optimistic. They're lowballing the cost to get politicians to buy the project. And then once they start funding it, then they come back and say, oops, the cost of concrete and steel has gone way up. We couldn't have foreseen this, but it's happened anyway. And you wouldn't want to waste the money we've already spent on it. So you'll have to appropriate more money to allow us to finish the project. So that's what's really happening with the cost overruns. But even without the cost overruns, it's just incredible how much these systems cost today. Mm-hmm. You know, in the 1950s, Toronto built its first subway system, first subway line. And in today's dollars, it cost about $70 million a mile for a subway. Today, Toronto is spending more than $1 billion a mile on a new subway line. In the 1970s, Edmonton was building a light rail line, and it cost like $12 million a mile, some insignificant number. And now we're seeing light rail lines cost $300, $400, and $500 million a mile. The same thing is true with the SkyTrain in Vancouver. The first ones are cheap, now they're really expensive.
Wow. So there's a lot of information here in the report, and I encourage, again, people to look at it on the Frontier website. It's a fascinating report because you really give us reality therapy, Randall, on the nature of these light rail systems. It's not just the low passenger volume. It's also their speed is relatively slow. What would speed have to do with this?
Well, you keep using the term light rail, and it's important to understand that light rail is the kind of rail that you see in Calgary and Edmonton and Ottawa. The subways in Montreal and Toronto are called heavy rail. And people think that that has something to do with weight, that heavy rail cars weigh more than light rail cars. So the rails they ride on weigh more than light rail rails. In fact, that's not true. Light rail cars actually weigh more than heavy rail cars, and the rails they use are the same. What the light and heavy refer to is capacity. Light rail is light capacity. It's low capacity transit. Heavy rail is supposed to be high capacity transit. But you want to know what's really high capacity transit? It's that newfangled contraption called the bus. A heavy rail train can hold maybe 800 people. A light rail train can hold maybe 450 people. But for safety reasons, you can only run the light rail trains about 20 times an hour. You can only run the heavy rail trains about 25, or maybe if you've got a really good signaling system, 30 times an hour. I've seen busways that run 250 to 300 buses an hour. There are busways in the world that can run 600 buses an hour or more. Wow. And while each bus is individually smaller than a light rail or heavy rail train, because you can run so many more, you actually can have higher capacity. And here's the really neat thing about buses. You don't have to spend $1 billion a mile to start a bus line. So if you've got a route that needs to move 1,000 people an hour, you just run enough buses to move 1,000 people. If you've got a route that needs to move 50,000 people an hour, you run more buses on that route. With light rail or heavy rail, first you have to spend $500 million to $1 billion a mile before you can run anything at all. And then if you don't get the usage, you aren't able to justify spending all that money in the first place.
So buses, really, we've got to bring them back, right, Randall? I mean, it's almost like, well, where's the bus industry? It's almost like they need to get involved because they're flexible, they're faster, more capacity. I mean, it's like on any count, you can't really compare it to these rail systems.
Well, here's the weird thing about rail. You build a rail line and you maybe if you're building a rail line from point A to point B, you might have had a bus going from point A to point B, and you've replaced that bus with the rail line. But then you have another bus that went from point C to point B, and another bus that went from point D to point B, and they went sort of parallel to the first bus that went from point A to point B. What you do is, instead of running those second and third buses, is that you reroute them to go into the rail line. They become feeder buses into the rail line, so people have to change from a bus to a train, and that slows down their ride. You asked about how fast these trains are, and they're about 20, 25 miles an hour for light rail, a little bit faster for heavy rail. So when you have to change from a bus to a rail, it slows down the ride. But what it also means is you're going to need a lot more buses to feed all those rail lines. So if you're a bus manufacturer, you don't lose when they build rail, because they have to buy more buses from you to run those trains. So the bus manufacturers don't have any interest in lobbying against rail. The only people who want to lobby against rail are the people who are going to have to pay for it, the taxpayers. And and then to some degree, if the rails are built in the streets, the people who are going to have to drive on narrower streets because the rails are now occupying some of the lanes that they used to be able to drive on.
You know, I'm speaking with Randall O'Toole about a landmark report regarding transit in Canada. I encourage you to read it, and I encourage your questions. There's so many angles to this issue, and I mean, so please enter them into the chat. We'd love to hear from you. I guess one of my key questions here, Randall, is how do we get out of this? It seems like the stars are aligned between industry players and politicians who want those pictures with the ribbons cuttings to all kinds of angles. It's just like in the culture now, certainly in Canada, everybody thinks it's cool to have a rail transit system, even like it sounds like it's kind of fundamentally, as you say, archaic, and really can't even compare to bus systems in this case. I mean, so how do we turn this around?
I think we're going to have to appeal to transit riders and other travelers. If you don't work downtown, transit doesn't work for you in any city in Canada. Transit just doesn't work for people who don't work downtown. So for most people, they're having to spend all this money on transit, but they don't find it very useful. You know, maybe they would take it to a ball game or something a couple times a year, but they don't find it useful most of the time. And so transit is hurting people. It's especially hurting low-income people, because oftentimes the taxes used to support these transit lines are regressive taxes. And we think, oh, we're building transit to help low-income people who can't afford to own a car get to work. Well, it turns out most low-income people do own a car, because they know they can reach 10 times as many jobs in a car as they can reach in transit.
Sorry, and can so you repeat that one again? I think people would be surprised to hear that statistic, Randall.
You can reach more jobs in 20 minutes in a car than you can in 60 minutes on transit. And in a 20-minute trip in a car, you can reach 10 times as many jobs as you can reach in a 20-minute ride on transit. So you can just, automobiles give you access to far more economic opportunities, better lower-cost housing, lower-cost consumer goods, access for your products if you're a manufacturer, access for your services if you're a worker and you're doing any kind of work, whether it's gig work or, you know, high tech work or, you know, home construction or whatever. Cars give you far better access than transit to work. And one of the interesting statistics, which we don't have as good data for Canada as we have for the United States, but one of the interesting statistics for the United States is, if you live in a household that doesn't have a car, you are more likely to drive alone to work than you are to take transit. Now, how is it that you're driving alone to work if you don't have a car? Well, it turns out you're using a car supplied by your employer. Maybe you're a plumber or an electrician or a cabinet maker. And so they give you a van that has all your tools and parts and stuff in it. you drive it home at night, and then in the next day you drive to work in it. And so transit doesn't even work for people who don't have cars.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, the data show if you want access to jobs, you can get better access on a bicycle than you can by urban transit in most cities. And again, I'm looking at American cities, but even in New York, you can get better access on a bicycle than you can on urban transit. New York City, of course, has the best transit system in America, and it's that bad that a bicycle is better.
Wow. So a lot of takeaways from there. And actually, one of the, I'm going to come back to that in a sec, because basically you said rail transit is really socially unjust. And I think that's a really critical point. I mean, it's not really fair that you have all these people, because it are, okay, so I have a question from the audience. Are any transit systems paid for by tickets?
Not in the United States or Canada, no. Actually, there is one. It's Atlantic City, New Jersey is paid for out of tickets. And in San Juan, Puerto Rico, there's a system of buses called the Publicos that are paid for out of fares. But other than that, almost all of them are subsidized. I guess I should say there's one more. There's a ferry boat system in New York City called the New York City Waterway that's paid for out of tickets.
But the point is that almost all transit systems are heavily subsidized by the taxpayer, because it can't just be operating. You've also got to pay for the capital, right, or amortize it out. But it's all subsidized.
Yes, in general, before the pandemic, fares paid only about 30 to 35% of the cost of operating transit. And when you add capital cost in, you're down to 25%. Since the pandemic, transit ridership has been a little lower, and fares are paying more like 10 to 20% of costs. So fares don't come close. And here's the real problem with that. If you're a transit agency, and most of your money is coming from tax dollars, which are appropriated by politicians, rather than fares, then you put most of your efforts into designing your transit system to please the politicians, not to serve the transit riders. Whoa. So since we're subsidizing these transit systems, they don't have any need or pressure to serve people outside of downtowns. And so they leave their transit systems, 120 years old, following 120 year old travel patterns that don't make sense today, because they don't get their money from the riders, so they don't care about how many riders they carry. Wow. And one of the things we learned during the pandemic was that when ridership goes down, subsidies go up to make up for the decline in ridership. Wow.
Yes, indeed.
And that means that they are totally divorced from any need to take care of their riders.
So that's a great section within the report, is what happened during the pandemic. And as you say, those subsidies just went up because they had to fill in all these gaps in revenue because the ridership went way down. So are those trends continuing with lower ridership? Are we back to pre-pandemic levels, Randall?
Ridership is not back to pre-pandemic levels. In Canada, it's better than it is in the United States. It's around 80% of pre-pandemic levels, whereas in the United States, it's only about 75%. But I don't think it's ever going to reach pre-pandemic levels because so many people are working at home. And the people the increase in the people working at home has taken a bigger bite out of transit than it has out of driving to work. That's because so many of the transit riders were people who worked downtown, and downtown office workers are the people who are most likely to be able to work at home. Also, a lot of people who have a car were taking transit to work because they wanted to avoid congestion. Well, now that a lot of people are working at home, there's less congestion. So people who were previously taking transit to work, if they don't work at home, are now driving to work in less congested conditions. So that's a double whammy that's hit transit systems. And I'm convinced that transit will never recover. Driving has already recovered from the pandemic. Flying has recovered from the pandemic, but transit hasn't, and I don't think it ever will recover because of the high numbers of people working at home.
So are you sensing, you looked at 8 cities. Is there a way to kind of highlight some of the key findings? I mean, I think you've done a masterful job summarizing a number of the key themes off the report, but were there things that surprised you in any of the particular cities that you looked at in Canada?
Well, you know, I think I took a closest look at Calgary than any other city, partly because I had better data from Calgary than any other city. And one of the things the data showed was that when they built light rail, after they built light rail, ridership increased. And you think, oh, good, ridership is increasing because of the light rail. But if you go back before the light rail was built, ridership was increasing before the light rail was built too. And in the 10 years before the light rail opened, ridership increased faster than in the 10 years after the first light rail line opened. So the light rail slowed the rate of increase in ridership. Now, why would that be? It's because light rail is so expensive that they were unable to make improvements in bus service in the rest of the system. They ended up focusing on the light rail corridors and ignoring the rest of the system. This made the transit system much more oriented downtown than it might have been. Calgary has something like 260 different bus routes. And a lot of those bus routes don't have to go downtown. Most of them do, some of them don't, but most of them do. One part of the report looks at Calgary and says, let's redesign the transit system so that it serves people in other economic centers like the university or the airport or the medical center in South Calgary or the retail center south of downtown. What if we serve all of those centers with our transit system as well as the system today serves downtown? Well, then you could pick up a lot of transit riders going to those other economic centers. And you wouldn't necessarily lose that many downtown riders. And to do that, I designed a system that required only 240 bus routes instead of the 260 or 70 that they have today. It would actually save money. It would cost less money to operate a bus system that serves all of the major economic centers of the region than the current system that only serves downtown.
Wow. No, it is really quite remarkable, the results from this report that you show. And you'd think that, I know that I use this word deliberately, but these systems are really not sustainable financially, are they? I mean, you hear, you know, debate after debate now across these 8 cities, from Ottawa to Vancouver, everywhere in between, you've got systems that are really kind of imploding under the weight of these poor ridership numbers and the major costs. So will this not force them to look at these decisions and say, wow, this makes no sense that we're putting in all these rail transit systems because we can't afford it?
Well, transit agencies, I'm convinced, are in total denial of reality. And they have been in total denial because they've been able to propagandize people. They talk about how transit helps poor people. They talk about how transit is greener than driving. They talk about how transit relieves congestion. And so they get support from a wide variety of people. When you look at the numbers, transit does more harm to poor people than it does good, because most poor people are driving to work and they're having to pay regressive taxes to support transit rides they aren't taking. Transit uses more energy per passenger mile that it carries than the average car. And unless most of your electricity comes from hydroelectric dams, rail transit, you know, generates more greenhouse gases to generate that electricity. In Alberta, for example, most of the electricity comes from burning fossil fuels. So the Calgary and Edmonton light rail systems are spewing out more greenhouse gases per passenger mile carried than the average car. just because the fossil fuel is required to support those light rail lines are spewing out greenhouse gases. And as far as relieving congestion goes, transit simply doesn't carry enough people in most cities to have an impact on congestion.
Okay.
New York City, definitely it does.
You've crossed the boundaries of discussion. You're saying that these rail systems are bad for the environment? Is that what you just said? And cars are better? You got to be kidding.
Well, certainly in Alberta now, and most of the rest of the Canada, most electricity comes from hydroelectric dams or things like that that aren't generating greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. But then you have to count what is the greenhouse gas cost of building a transit line that's dedicated to carrying a few people, a small percentage of the travelers in the region to work. And that generates huge amounts of greenhouse gases because you need lots of concrete, you need lots of steel, and that generates a lot of greenhouse gases. And it takes decades of operational savings to make up for that. And you wonder, you know, we can make cars more efficient. We can make them generate less greenhouse gases with one easy step. We relieve traffic congestion. And building light rail or heavy rail doesn't relieve much congestion. Adding new lanes onto an existing freeway doesn't generate much greenhouse gases, doesn't generate as much per mile as building a rail line, but it does relieve a lot of congestion and allows people to travel with less greenhouse gas emissions.
Wow.
So, you know, you'd have to sit down and look at it city by city. We don't have all the data we need to do that for Canada. But yes, I would say it's easily possible that driving cars like a Toyota Prius or something like that is much greener than driving than riding transit. The average car is greener than transit in at least Alberta and probably in other parts of Canada. So you'd have to look at it on a city by city basis.
Okay. So when we look at the bigger picture, though, like it's a tremendous report because you're giving the entire 360 degree view here of this issue. And I think for me, one of the things that I find fascinating is how are these decisions made? Like they're involving billions of dollars in every case. And yet you'd think you'd be looking at the options. Because in good public policy, you do options analysis. You'd say, well, you know, this is a light rail approach. Well, what about buses? Or what about building better roads to enable people to have more flexibility, say, in their car and have less traffic congestion? So it sounds like we're not doing basic policy analysis then. Am I being too hard on these people?
No, I don't think you are. They often will hire engineering firms to do the alternatives analysis. And the engineering firms know that if they decide to build a rail line, that those same engineering firms are probably going to get hired to do the design work and the engineering work for the rail line. So they have an incentive to distort the outcome. So what they typically do, if they consider a bus alternative at all compared to rails, is they'll cripple the bus alternative. They'll say things like that. Well, like if we run 20 buses an hour, we won't be able to move as many people as if we run 20 trains an hour. So light rail beats buses. They won't consider the fact that you could easily run 150 to 200 buses an hour on the same city streets that you're running 20 buses an hour. And you can easily carry more people than the light rail if you ever need to. I even reviewed one report that said they put together a bus alternative and then they put together a rail alternative that had all the bus improvements in it plus rail. And for some reason, they found that the bus alternative alone attracted more riders than the bus alternative with rails. And so they went back and they deleted a lot of the bus lines from the rail alternative to make the rail alternative come out as to having more riders. And then they said to the public, oh, we have to build the rails to get more riders. And this was right in their reports that nobody but me read. But they said we deliberately set out and crippled the bus alternative to make it seem like it had fewer riders than the rail alternative.
That is so wrong. So one of the parts here I want to do, I want to highlight because I certainly walk through this process with you regarding this report, is getting the data, getting the information in Canada has not been easy, has it, to Randall, in terms of preparing this report?
Well, in the United States, we have a little bit more centralized government system, which is very ironic because, as we know, Canada was meant to be centralized. The United States
Yeah,
is designed to be
originally.
decentralized, and we ended up just exactly the opposite. So we have all these federal agencies that hand out money, and as a condition of handing out money, they require local agencies to submit a lot of data back to them, and then they publish the data. So we have enormous amounts of data for every transit system, for every highway system, for every airline, for every rail line. We've got tremendous amounts of data going back for decades. And in looking at Canadian cities, there is no federal repository of data. There's no federal collector. So you go to the individual agencies, and an example was Vancouver. Vancouver had a transit agency, and then they renamed the agency and restructured a little bit of it, and the new agency threw out all the old data. They have no data from before the time the new agency was created. And so I couldn't get any data from earlier than that.
But clearly,
And
one of
so
the
basically,
recommendations of your report is that the provinces who really are on the front line of collecting that data, the ministries of transportation, really need to get their act together and make sure this data is requirement, especially because the province is largely funding a lot of this nonsense.
yes, and it's important to have your analysis be data oriented, and instead of being intuitive oriented. There was a famous study done of Los Angeles Transit, and the researcher would go to politicians and say, "Now, light rail goes 20 miles an hour. There are buses that go 30 miles an hour, and light rail can move 9,000 people an hour. There are bus lanes that can move 30,000 people an hour. Why do you support light rail?" "Well, because it's so fast. Everybody's going to want to ride it because it's going to be so much faster than buses." "Well, I just informed you that it was slower than buses." "Yes, but it can move so many more people than buses." So, it's all based on intuition and mythology and not based on reality. So we need to separate mythology from reality. We need to also understand, how much is $1 billion anyway? People don't really understand $1 million, much less a billion. I think most people understand $1,000, but one famous cartoonist pointed out that we understand 100 and we understand one. So if you say this is going to cost $100 million, whereas this is going to cost only $1 billion, it sounds like 1 billion is less than 100 million.
So let's give our heads a shake and let's look at the data and evidence. That's for sure. So we have an audience question as well here. Do you think, Randall, that it would be more cost effective for a city to have a fleet of electric cars for citizens to have a subscription to use? What do you think, Randall?
Well, that could be. I don't even think the city needs to do that. If cities stop subsidizing transit systems, I think you would see private transit spring up. I mean, our transit systems are so bad today that if you go to places like Seattle and San Francisco, you'll see a lot of white buses driving around, and they're sometimes called Google buses, because Google has a whole fleet of buses to help its workers get to work. And Apple has a fleet of buses, and Microsoft has a fleet of
You're
buses,
right.
Facebook has a fleet of buses. That's because the transit systems don't work. Their offices aren't downtown, and so if they want to get their people to work by transit, they have to provide their own buses. Ford Motor Company actually owned a private bus company a few years ago called Chariot, that they were running around Boston and San Francisco and other cities. They finally gave up because they couldn't compete against the heavily subsidized transit systems. But if we ended transit subsidies, we would see private transit grow up where it makes sense. And that means buses, not trains.
You know, what's an interesting aside here, though, is, you know, the whole use of electrics. You really have to look at it carefully, don't you, in terms of there's a lot of subsidization going on with EVs, and that makes it more complicated, doesn't it? It kind of clouds our decision making.
Well, EVs are a different issue. You know, if you say we have to have electric rail transit because it'll save greenhouse gases, you can say, well, why don't we just have electric cars and electric buses? Part of the issue is we don't have the generating capacity to generate enough electricity to support all of our transportation. We're lucky that only 1 or 2% of all travel in the United States and Canada or Canada uses rails to move passengers. Most of it is using buses or cars or trucks, and they're mostly fossil fuel powered. The power used to power all of our transportation is about 130% of our electrical grid. So if we gave up electric heating and electric lighting and electric kitchens and used all of our electrical power for transportation, we still wouldn't have enough to support the transportation system we have today. Okay. So, you know, EVs are right now a curiosity. They're not selling that well because they're a lot more expensive, even with subsidies. And then there's the whole range anxiety problem that, you know, especially in remote parts of Canada and the United States, it's hard to find chargers. So, and the batteries only last a few years. And then, you know, I have a friend who has an electric car and he drives it around his neighborhood, but the batteries only last 9 miles today. So, you know, it was a great car when it was brand new, but now he can only drive 5 miles and has to rush home to plug it in.
No kidding. So part of the challenge with EVs is the battery life. Their range does tend to decrease over time. Is that the pattern?
Yes. Yes. Okay. And their range especially decreases in cold temperatures, which isn't a problem in Canada, of right. course.
No, of course not. Not in Canada. So one of the questions, though, I would have is with rail transit, is there a benefit, though, to allowing so-called more density of development and being able to promote more economic development and moving towards the utopian ideals of a 15-minute city, Randall? Surely this is the pathway and the reason why, although rail transit doesn't compare with buses, we should be still going ahead with them because we can create more 15-minute cities.
Well, we had 15-minute cities about 200 years ago. The only way of getting around cities was on foot. Most people couldn't afford to own a horse or a carriage. A few people did, but most people couldn't. So the only way was getting around on foot. So everything had to be within walking distance of where you lived. The jobs weren't downtown because we didn't have factories in 200 years ago. And so the jobs were located scattered all around the city. The retailers were scattered all around the city, and so on and so forth. And then we got new technologies. We got horse cars. We got ferry boats. And then eventually we got cable cars and electric street cars. And people didn't need to have everything within 15 minutes of their home anymore. And so they spread outwards. And then we got the automobile. And they really spread outwards. And so the people who are saying 15-minute city want to turn the clock back 200 years. The people who are saying rail transit only want to turn the clock back 120 years. And the idea that we can use them both in combination, you know, have a rail transit system that is lined with high density housing projects, you know, it sounds great on paper. But first of all, most people don't want to live in high density housing projects. You end up having less privacy, There's more noise. You don't have a yard for your children and pets to play in. And it is not as comfortable. You can't expand if your family grows. You can't put add a new room onto your apartment to accommodate that growth. So high density housing is not where people want to live. And then there's the problem of, hey, guess what? High density housing actually costs more than single family homes. Because if you're building a 4, 5, or 6 story apartment building, which is what you're seeing spring up along the transit lines, they call them transit oriented developments, you need a lot more concrete, you need a lot more steel to support the upper stories, and you need elevators to get people to those upper stories. Because people aren't going to climb 4 or 5 flights of stairs to get to their apartments. And all of those things cost more, which means that a 4-story building costs twice as much per square foot as a single family home. A 5-story building can cost 3 times as much, and so on and so forth. It just costs more and more per square foot. And so in order to accommodate that, you end up with smaller and smaller apartments. I'm seeing apartments being built that are like 260 square feet per unit. And they say, look, we built these units for only $400,000.
Whoa.
And we got a 260 square foot apartment. And, you know, for $400,000, you can build a 200,000 or 2,000 square foot single family home. Wow. So that's hardly a victory.
So within the Canadian context, though, and you studied this market well, and of course, our senior fellow at Frontier, Wendell Cox, has done a masterful job documenting the affordability, the high cost of housing across Canada. What's the main reason why housing is so darn expensive in select markets in Canada?
Well, you hit the nail on the head when you said in select markets. You know, Vancouver is one of the most expensive housing markets, not in Canada, but in the entire world. Yeah. There's only a handful that are more expensive than Vancouver. Yeah, you know, and Toronto and Montreal are pretty expensive. Calgary and Edmonton are getting up there, and Winnipeg is still pretty affordable. And what are the differences? And the difference is in the amount of regional planning that's going on in these provinces. In 1964, the British Columbia Parliament passed a law that created what's now called the Greater Vancouver Regional District. And it guides growth, not just for the city of Vancouver, but for all of the suburbs, you know, from Surrey to Burnham and so on and so forth, North Vancouver, whatever. And one of the things they did early on was they drew an urban growth boundary and they said, no new housing will be built outside of this boundary. And instead, we're going to build up, not out. We're going to build high density housing projects. So you're going to see 5-story buildings or 10-story apartment buildings spring up next to your single family home. And that has not made housing cheaper. It's made it more expensive because, as I say, those high density housing projects cost a lot more to build. It's greatly increased the cost of land. And so even if you build 50 units per acre instead of 10 units per acre, it costs a lot more. The land costs a lot more per unit because the land is more than 5 times as expensive as it would be without that urban growth boundary. So these growth limits are what's made housing expensive. And, you know, I look at the map and I look at, you know, here in the United States, we have Oregon and California, which have growth boundaries and housing is really expensive here. And then we have Texas, which everybody thinks is big, you know, Texas and big go together. It's the second largest state and so on. And then we have British Columbia, which is 40% larger than Texas. And British Columbia is running out of land. So you have to confine Vancouver growth to, you know, 1% of the entire province.
Okay, but to be clear, you're saying that sarcastically, Randall. You're pretty dry with your sense of humor. Wow, we have tons of land, and yet we are confining people in these land bubbles and creating a nightmare for the next generation because they will never own a home.
Yes, and we the Greater Vancouver Regional District planners knew that when they were doing it. They hired
Pardon
a
me?
European planner named Hans Blumenfeld, and he they brought him in because they knew they were trying to design a European style city in Vancouver, and they thought he would come in and pat them on the back and tell them they were doing a wonderful job. And he looked at it and he said, "Look, you've got this giant province here. You've got zillions of acres of forest. You've got hundreds of thousands of acres of farmlands. You don't need to do this. You're going to make housing really expensive, and you're not going to save anything, as far as green space or recreation areas, or it's not going to make farming more expensive or logging more expensive. All you're going to do is make housing more expensive." And they ignored it. They poo-pooed it.
Wow.
20
And
years
it's all there.
later, 30 years
You can
later,
read this report, right, Randall?
in fact, you can download it from my website. But
Okay.
30 years later, I was asked to look at housing in or the land use planning in Vancouver, and I said the same thing. And when I went to Vancouver and talked about it, the planners in the audience laughed in my face, literally. They just said, "Oh, no. We don't have anything to do with the high housing prices at all. It would be silly for us to allow more land to be devoted to housing."
Wow. But this is the whole philosophy of so-called smart growth, is it not, Randall? Like the whole idea that we are smart and we're going to create smart growth because we know better in terms of really creating that kind of land use rules that would create a land bubble that would escalate the cost ultimately of what you pay for a house and make it totally unaffordable. Certainly in the Vancouver market alone, and it is a poster child of foolishness in terms of policy in the world now, because it costs 12 to 14 times the average family income. So who can afford that? Almost nobody.
Yes, and the one thing that the planners are really good at is coming up with great language to support their arguments.
Yes.
They invented the term smart growth. If you talk to the people who first used the term smart growth, which came out of Maryland, they said, "We invented that term so that we could call anybody who disagreed with us d in favor of dumb growth." Well, I
Yes,
looked up the
exactly.
definition of smart. And the original definition of smart is not wise or intelligent, but a sharp, stinging pain. And so that's, I think, what they mean by smart growth. We're going to make this growth as painful as possible for you by
Wow.
making housing as expensive as possible and forcing you to live in apartments, making it difficult for you to drive around, and forcing you to ride our expensive train sets.
Well, this has certainly been a powerful conversation, Randall, because you look at these kinds of policies and you look at rail transit, where we're spending billions of dollars and we're really not making, as your report summarizes so well, wise decisions. And wise decisions should be about serving the people, serving the transit riders, serving the larger community, because cities are not just places to live. They are, as the famous Alain Berthaud says, cities are not just cities to live. They are places for labor exchange. People go there to find a job, and employers go there to find an employee. So you've got to make a community livable, affordable, but also a place where people can get around within about an hour. Otherwise, it's not going to be, people are not going to take those jobs. And so this is a very important issue. So what can we do to move the ball forward then when it comes to the foolishness of this kind of policy? And there's a lot of money being spent. What can we do as citizens other than to read this report, Randall?
Well, read this report or a summary and pass it out to as many of your friends as possible. Really, we're on this trend line towards wasting billions, tens of billions of dollars on archaic transportation systems. We need to reverse that. I recently read a paper. It was called The Global Cost of Driving. And they talked about traffic deaths, they talked about pollution and so on and so forth. But if you look at the numbers in the United States and Canada, traffic fatalities peaked about 50 years ago. Pollution peaked about 50 years ago. We drive, you know, three times as much today as we did 50 years ago, and yet total pollution from cars is down by 90%, even though we're driving three times as much. Fatalities are way down, even though we're driving three times
as
much. So
that's a great story.
Which means that the problems of the automobile can be solved without forcing people to drive less. Mm-hmm. Instead of talking about the cost of driving, we need to talk about the benefits of driving, how the cars give us access to more jobs, better housing, more recreation areas. Cars played a key role in the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. It's no coincidence that women's rights dramatically increased after families were able to afford two cars instead of just one, so that both the parents, you know, both husband and wife could drive to work even if they weren't working in the same place. So cars have given us tremendous amounts of benefits. And against those benefits, the costs have been low, and we can make the cost lower by improving automobile technology better than we can do it by trying to get people to drive less.
Okay. I think that's a very good challenge, Randall, as we get to the closing of our really fine discussion, is you're challenging us to remember the benefits of various transit systems, including buses, but also the automobile. We should not take that for granted. So we need to speak up and share it. I encourage our audience to share this discussion interview with your friends, colleagues, or even elected officials. But we need to take a critical view at these issues to better serve the people. I mean, how can you be against that? So I do have one final question, Randall, because would you believe it or not, in Canada on April the 1st, just around the corner, we're going to have a quadrupling of the federal taxes, the carbon taxes on our fuel. Do carbon taxes work, Randall? What do you think?
Well, if we agree that that global warming is a serious problem, it's an existential crisis, and I think carbon taxes are the best way to go. When I read the reports about global warming, they say that global warming in 100 years is going to reduce our gross domestic product by 5%. And I'm saying, wait a minute, you know, 5%, we're supposed to spend trillions of dollars extra today on transportation and heating our homes and everything else to save 5% of gross national product. That's almost a rounding error for 100 years from now.
Exactly.
And so I think global warming might be real, but it's not an existential problem. And it's not necessarily, the solution is not necessarily to make people pay a lot more today. We can get cars that are more fuel efficient without necessarily quadrupling fuel prices.
Exactly. So again, we need to put these issues into perspective, because I mean, I look at the taxes that we already pay, they are having a huge impact on the middle class, everyone, in terms of their ability to have a successful life. So this is certainly top of mind for many Canadians. Well, look, Randy,
the other thing I want to say is that if they start collecting those taxes, where are they going to go? Where I've seen carbon taxes go is into things that generate more carbon emissions. They aren't reducing carbon with the money they're spending on it. So it was a bad idea in the first place. Just collect those taxes and then spend them on things that generate more carbon emissions.
Well, in this case, they go into, I believe, general revenue. So they go into just making our government larger. And certainly in this case, in the federal government case, the numbers are stunning, where we have a federal government that spent more money than all previous governments combined. So we really do have a major spending issue that is really in effect a tax on the next generation, which, you know, how caring or fair is that? So regardless, we've had a far-reaching conversation, Randall, as we've talked about your report that you were the lead author on regarding rail transit in Canada. And we so much appreciate sharing your insights today with us.
I'm glad to be here, and I hope to have more discussions with you in the future.
Well, thank you, Randall, and thank you to the audience for joining us and for your questions. And we urge you to look at the Frontier Center website and subscribe to our newsletter, and to certainly like this program and share it with others. And in the meantime, on this March the 14th, I wish you and your family all the very best.